Welcome to the Week in Review and our panel of voices analyzing and making sense of the last 7 days. One voice you won't hear this hour, however, is Bill Radke. He has the day off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 Fox News sitting in for Bill. I'm an occasional guest, but today I sit in the host chair. Here with me, Rob McKenna, the former Republican Washington Attorney General, Ron Sims, the former Democratic King County Executive, and Sidney Brownstone, the current staff writer at The Stranger. Now, we begin with the jungle. It was a few weeks ago that Seattle Mayor Ed Murray's senior advisor, Scott Lindsay, laid out the city's plan to clear, some would say sweep, the troubled homeless encampment under I-5.
One, transition people living in unsanctioned encampments under the freeway with meaningful offers of shelter and services. Two, clean up major health hazards, including human waste and garbage, and remove overgrown brush and other fire hazards.
Now, that clean-out plan had a hard deadline of 2 weeks. Union Gospel Mission was enlisted to outreach and refer campers to shelter and services. But after a lot of backlash from homeless advocates this week, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, he dropped the deadline and admitted their plan wasn't as thought out as first appeared.
I don't have the answers. We're actually making this up as we go along. I don't have an ideological position on this, because I want to find out what we can do and what we can do right.
Sidney Brownstone, is the mayor right to take his foot off the sweep pedal and basically admit that they don't know what they're doing?
Well, duh. I mean, I think Tim Harris, the founder of Real Change, said it best, that the original strategy to clear out the jungle in 2 weeks was not a human services strategy. It was a displacement strategy. And, you know, the estimate of people living there ranges from 200 to 400. The idea that UGM would suddenly find room for all those people, get services, mental health treatment, addiction treatment, and the city wouldn't allocate any additional funding is preposterous.
Was the mayor's candor appreciated by advocates?
Well, I think that he tried to backpedal and say that he never put a hard deadline on it. But, the two-week thing did come from his administration.
Ron Sims, you have certainly dealt with this issue. The argument that seemed to slow this all down is what Sidney talked about, this idea that it's hard to transition folks. A lot of them have possessions, pets, partners, all of which are basically discouraged and not allowed in shelters. How do you accommodate jungle campers in our system?
Well, I think right now they're in an emergency situation. I don't support the jungle. I was in Operation Night Watch for years, and it was called the jungle for a reason. Yeah. And the rules are there are different. You've created a culture of homelessness that has its own rules, its own goals, tend to be more survival. But if you're going to close down the jungle, then I think it's really important that there be a really well-organized system put in place to deal with underlying issues of addiction, of mental health, and those are really important because you have to break up the culture of being a homeless person. A person who's homeless is at a survival mode. It's difficult then to move them and have no services or no structures around them that allow them to feel that they're surviving, but they're not surviving with their tent and a sleeping bag. So hopefully we've learned a lot so that we will endeavor over the next several months of better weather to actually put together a system. I like Downtown Seattle Services Center. They do a very good job at wrapping services around the person who's homeless. The YWCA does the same thing, and we need more of that. But you just can't all of a sudden – what I worry about is that what we're faced with is defining how we're going to handle homelessness. And I keep thinking, but we're doing it wrong. So why don't we take the time during the better weather period to begin to put in the structures that actually work? From a HUD perspective, we would not support we had homelessness all over the country. Some people actually stepped up to it with regular planning. They did it all year long, year after year after year. This, what we're faced with today, should never have caught us by surprise. It meant that something broke down somewhere.
Rob McKenna, we have been trying to tackle homelessness, not just the jungle, but the larger issue of homelessness for years. I mean, a lot of smart people have committed their lives to this. There's been a lot of money. There's been a lot of effort. And yet, it gets worse, not better.
Well, you'll never completely eliminate it, unfortunately, but you can ameliorate it, as we've seen happen with chronic public inebriates, as they're now called, people who are alcoholics. It turns out that giving them a place to live is a better alternative to allowing them to die on the streets. It's more humane, and they're allowed to consume alcohol in these units, which is not ideal, but is better than having them consume it on the street. The thing about the jungle is this. It is a concentration of the problem in a relatively small area. And what we know from problems like homelessness and other kinds of social ills is that concentrating them in a constrained area makes the problems worse. So even if they are being displaced and moved out to a broader area, that is better than having them concentrated in this one location, which is dangerous, and which we are effectively encouraging people to frequent by allowing it to remain. The incidents of rape and sexual assault there are horrific and are a byproduct of that concentration effect.
But the worry is if you do clean up and they do move out to other areas, maybe in smaller numbers, but you haven't solved the problem and you'll still have people camping out, getting into trouble.
You've solved that problem, which is having so many of them in one place. So that is a problem that is addressed. Secondly, by clearing out the jungle over time and then keeping it cleared out, which you have to do with enforcement, you don't create a massive displacement overnight. You do it over a period of weeks or months so that you have a chance to move people into services who will accept services, to move people into other locations that are safer. But you do it in a methodical way using the service surround model that Ron is talking about, which is, in fact, the right way to do it.
But do we have the service surround model, Sydney Brownstone? Part of the problem is that there just isn't permanent housing that you can bring a partner, a pet, and possessions. I mean, what they're offering, as I understand it, Union Gospel Mission, are you know, shelter space, mats on floors. And maybe it's no wonder jungle people aren't taking them up in that, because their situation in a tent is actually better in their eyes.
Absolutely. I mean, I've spoken to homeless people. I've spoken to formerly homeless people who find the conditions at UGM to be incredibly cramped and not private. In addition, it's a religiously affiliated organization, which is not welcoming to all people. I mean, the other question we're not talking about is why were people drawn to the jungle in the first place, right? It's relatively isolated. A lot, you know, we were talking about addiction issues earlier. We don't have safe consumption sites. We don't have safe injection sites. And if you clear out the jungle over time, you know, there's a large contingent of people who don't want to live in shelters. They would prefer to live under the shelter of a freeway. So where do they go? Do they go to places that are more isolated, where it's harder to reach them with services? I think services first and a harm reduction model is something that we should be striving for. And that's something that's been supported by council members, Shama Sawant and Mike O'Brien. You know, get trash services in there, get Sharps containers, get porta potties first, you know, give people basic human rights first, and then they'll be able to transition.
Well, or they won't leave at all. I mean, that's the other possibility. I mean, I understand the motivation behind those ideas, absolutely. But does it actually encourage them to stay longer in that one area?
But here's an unpopular argument. Maybe that's all right. Maybe we should allow the jungle to be, in effect, a little more monitored encampment. I mean, it's actually provided shelter for hundreds over the years, with problems, to be sure, but if you actually added some services and some porta potties and that kind of stuff and sort of cleaned it up, is that maybe a better alternative since we don't have the space for a lot of these people?
That is, I'm stunned by that. Here we're in a very wealthy community. You see that in a third world countries, and people are clamoring to get out of those conditions. And you can't turn around here and say, well, we think it's reasonably, it's in our interest to sanction it. No, you don't. If it's not something that you want to see in the third world, in the developing world, in violent worlds, in migrant camps, you do not all of a sudden say it's okay to have that here. You have to do wraparound services and provide shelter. That's the key, because you have to break up the culture of being homeless. When a person's homeless, they're in a very much of a survival mode. And the rules that it takes to survive in those environments, the key is to disrupt that. But you have to be looking at programs all around the country that have been really, really effective, making sure people had health care, the dental care, the physical security, the ability to even take care of their pets, which was really important because a lot of people have them. But you got to break up the culture and with wraparound services. And we have programs. I mean, I don't know much about the – I mean, I know a lot about the programs here. The ones that I deeply admire are the YWCA, because people forget – a lot of the women are sexually assaulted, and the safe place has been at the YWCA.
As we close this up, you talk about more services as being the solution. Do we have a different mindset that's required, or do you feel like we know how to do it, we just haven't endowed that path? Or do we not really have an agreement on what to do? And that's part of the problem, is competing visions about the solution.
So Rob brought up the program that we did, which is basically take chronic inebriates and say, look, we're not going to tell you you have to be sober to come into the housing. So you can come in here and fall on the floor and be skunk drunk. But the program materially had a benefit. It reduced the cost of treatment at Harborview by $4 million a year. They have the largest AA group there, because once the people resolve the first issue of having a place to go, the ability to have counselors, the ability to have other people who were also in the same situation that were also trying to overcome their alcoholism and their drug addictions, they were present. So they have a very strong culture that has proven to be very, very effective.
Rob McKenna, a new ideology or new resources?
Well, I think you need both. And you have to recognize that the sources or causes of homelessness are complex. There's a lot of mental illness involved with some folks. There's drug addiction with others, some both. So it's a complicated problem requiring a layered solution, which is what Ron is speaking to here. And I think the city needs to be given time. People need to be patient to allow them to implement that solution. But hiding people away under a freeway, even if they say they want to be there, just doesn't strike me as the right approach.
We take our first quick break. Coming up later this hour, another salvo on the war on cars. Stay with us for that. We are back in just a few. It's the Week in Review. Welcome back to the Week in Review. We are tossing around and reacting to the recent headlines. We have McKenna, Sims, Brownstone, but not Radke. Bill's taking some R&R. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 Fox, filling in for him while he is away. This past Tuesday, Washington voters cast their ballots in our state's primary election. Trump, Donald Trump, as expected, swept on the GOP side, but somewhat unexpectedly, Hillary Clinton prevailed for Democrats. Unexpected, because back in March, you recall, when the party held their caucuses, Bernie Sanders won in a landslide with 73%. So each Democrat can now claim a victory here in Washington. But it is Sanders who will come away with nearly all of the delegates, because Tuesday's primary, well, those results don't count. Confused? Former state Democratic chair Dwight Pelz says it is time for a change.
I've come to the painful conclusions that I don't think we should be holding caucuses, and I know I'm probably out of step with a lot of my colleagues in the party. I think it's time to move to a primary. I think it's more democratic. It allows more people to vote, and that's what democracy is all about.
Ron Sims, you are a proud Democrat, been to countless caucuses, I'm sure. Are they still relevant, or more importantly, reliable, given, as you've heard, that they represent such a small slice of the electorate compared to a larger turnout primary?
I'm almost agnostic on it. I mean, what I prefer is to see what we saw, where you have to mark yourself as a Democrat when you vote and then be able to vote for a candidate. Sure, I'd like to see that. But the party has to make a decision about how it wishes to select its the candidate for offices. They have to decide how they wish to organize. And I've just, you know, not being a party activist, I just think I don't know what solution actually works well, because they differ all across the country.
Well, what about the argument that Dwight Pelz just made, that the solution he favors is the one that involves more people, which is the primary? I mean, tens of thousands of more people participate in the primary for Democrats than in the caucuses for Democrats.
Voting is very convenient. I voted with my ballot, and my caucus.
Did you caucus?
I went to the caucus to look. I was a Hillary supporter. I had to look all over for who to give my ballot to. It was crowded. It didn't feel organized. Would I prefer just to be able to get something to my home and vote? Yes.
Well, then why are you agnostic on whether we should have caucuses or not? Why not just do what Dwight Bell says and get rid of them and avoid the confusion?
Because part of me wants to say that the party itself has to make a decision about how it wishes to set up a system to select a candidate.
Rob McKenna, the GOP has basically ditched the caucuses in favor of the primary for the very reason we've talked about. They like the fact that more people participate. It's a broader statement. Size matters, electorate size for the GOP. You're on board with that?
Well, we still have caucuses, actually, in the Republican Party. It's just that we don't use them to select all of our delegates to the national convention. So you can still have caucuses and have a primary where people get to vote.
But you're not really encouraging people to go to them like the Democrats were. It felt more like a party organizing event
right.
for Republicans, not go cast your ballot for your favorite candidate.
It's a little of both, but it is more of the party organizing. And it's for people who are particularly interested in going to the legislative district caucus and then perhaps to the state convention and then the national convention. But people understood going in, you're right, that the primary vote would determine how the delegates are actually allocated at the national convention.
Do you think that's a better system?
I do for a couple reasons. Number one, I think it is easier for people to participate, and I think more people do participate when you set it up that way. And I've heard a lot of my friends who have attended Democratic caucuses express frustration about that. And I understand the Democratic Party's rationale because they think that it allows them to identify more potential volunteers and activists.
But doesn't it?
But it doesn't serve the voter very well, and I think that's why it ought to be changed.
But
One other thing, need to move we need to have a primary that's earlier in the year. May 24th, my goodness. I mean, we all thought, well, this would be the year. It'll matter this year. Well, you know, not really. We should move it up to March and have a Pac-12 primary like Secretary of State Wyman has recommended.
They have tried, but so far failed. Sidney Brownstone, Bernie Sanders, he, of course, won the caucus, as we said. But Hillary Clinton, with tens of thousands of more voters in Tuesday's primary, comes out the loser, actually. I mean, he gets most of the state's delegates because that's what the Democratic Party wanted to count, not the primary results. Is that fair?
I have to be honest with you. I've been trying my hardest to really understand the delegate system, and I've come up short. I think the Democratic Party needs to radically reorganize the way it does things. I mean, covering the precinct-level caucuses this year, I think people have a romantic notion for what it means to come together with your neighbors and discuss ideas civilly. But caucuses kind of inherently favor one type of voter, and that's someone who's relatively privileged, who can take off work, who, you know, has childcare, and can waste hours of their lives in, you know, a crowded high school gymnasium waving a postcard that you don't even know what happens to at the end of the day. It was, I mean, going to the legislative district caucuses, it was just absolute chaos. I have no idea how we elect a president this way. No idea.
Give the argument for why a caucus helps a party organize. I mean, a lot of people wonder, they feel archaic, they feel irrelevant, they feel unnecessary, that a primary does the job. But why do parties cling to these caucuses? Is it to get names, addresses, voter lists? What exactly does it do for parties?
It's a recruitment vehicle. You get names and addresses and follow-up.
Emails,
solicitations for funds. It's a mechanism to sustain parties.
I mean, that's why they die hard here in the state. They want that organizing tool.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And yet that whole system is kind of a vestige of the days when we had to, you know, put stamps on everything to mail out communications, and we didn't have social media and all these other ways for people to participate that we do today. The party system is a classic pyramid scheme, you know, where you try to get your grassroots level volunteers and your precinct captains and then your district chairs. And when you had to rely on an index card file to keep your volunteer data, that was a good way to do it. But now it's so different that people are increasingly frustrated with that old system.
You can join and follow our conversation today on Twitter at KUOW. This is the Week in Review, McKenna, Sims, and Brownstone after a break. Back now with a distinguished panel this Friday before Memorial Day. Our goal, you give us an hour, we will give you a week. We are KUOW's Week in Review. Sidney Brownstone with The Stranger, Rob McKenna, former Republican Attorney General, and Ron Sims, the former Democratic King County Executive. Bill Radke has the day off. It was a big week for Donald Trump, who formally clinched the Republican presidential nomination shortly after our state gave him 44 delegates on Tuesday. That put him almost over the top. All he needed was four more, which he got by week's end when some unbound delegates came his way.
I was coming out of my building this morning, and there was a big news flash that Donald Trump had won the nomination. And I said, what happened? I thought I had to wait a couple of more weeks. And they said, no, the delegates from your state right here, you, North Dakota, where are you? Where are you? Where are my delegates? Better stand up, please. So I guess you would call them unbound, but now they're bound.
Rob McKenna, what do you think of your party's new nominee?
Well, I think that he has walked into our primary system as a former Democrat and as an individual who doesn't actually hold a conservative philosophy, and won because he's gotten lots and lots of voters who are disaffected with the status quo to support him. The Republican regulars were supporting, you know, John Kasich, as I was, or Ted Cruz, or any number of other candidates, you know, Scott Walker and the rest. But there were a lot of voters who showed up in very high numbers who are essentially saying we need to fire the establishment. And all of the candidates that we had running, aside from Trump, were establishment figures. So he has effectively, hijacked the party, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, of course, but he has. I mean, he's walked in, he's followed the rules, and he's won because he got more votes. And none of us saw this coming.
Will you vote for him?
No, I won't vote for him.
Will you vote for Hillary Clinton?
I will not vote for Hillary.
Will you write in John Kasich?
I will write in John Kasich. As unfortunately, I could fill in the bubble on my primary ballot, and I'll have to actually write it out, but that's okay. I just, look, I'm a Republican, but I have to believe in the candidate, too. And just like most of us in this state don't vote a straight ticket, we can all point out people we voted for in the opposite party. I don't feel obligated to do that at the presidential level if I just can't stomach my party's nominee.
And you represent, a conundrum, if you will, for a lot of Republicans in the state,
yeah.
Some who can't embrace him and so are doing other things like you. Chris Vance, running for state Senate against Patty Murray, a GOP candidate, has denounced Trump, basically, like yeah. You, says he won't vote for him. Then there's those who are falling in line with Trump. I mean, the state party chair, Susan Hutchison, yeah. After the nomination said it's time to get behind him. So those are two opposite kind of reactions here. There does seem to be this third way, however. Republican gubernatorial candidate Bill Bryant, he's challenging Jay Inslee. He says he won't answer the question about who he's voting for. He's taking the fifth on Trump, this mid position. Is that an effective strategy, Rob McKenna?
Well, it's effective in the following sense. The people who hate Trump who are not Republicans aren't going to vote for Bryant anyway, so it's not like he's losing their votes. The people who are Republicans and who feel that anybody is better than Clinton will be mad at him if he comes out and says, I can't support Trump. This is what's happening to Chris Vance right now in his race for the U.S. Senate. He took a lot of heat at the state convention. He's had, he's had blowback from other Republican quarters because they're saying if you don't support Trump, then you're effectively supporting Clinton. And so I think Bryant is trying to avoid that. And so it's that's where he is right now.
Do you think he can get away with that through November?
I think he can. No one can force him to vote. I think it becomes less of an issue over time in the sense that you can only ask the same question so many times, and people get bored with it. So, there is some risk to it as well. There's no question about it.
Ron Sims, Chris Vance, it's been mentioned that he abandoned Trump. But he got a lot of grief actually from Democrats, not just from his own party, but Democrats, even though he's on their side, abandoning Trump.
Well, he didn't ever endorse Trump, so abandoning him might not be the right word.
Fair enough. Yeah. But he's on the side of not wanting Trump with the Democrats, and he's getting a lot of grief. I mean, why didn't Democrats, at least give him a little bit of praise if he did, quote-unquote, the right thing from their perspective?
Because he's running against a person who we want to see get reelected. But part of me says that what I like about this state is the willingness of people simply to say that Donald Trump, who is a racist and who is a sexist and who would not be good for this country, is not a candidate they can support. And you got to give them credit for that, because that takes guts. And I admire people who have the kinds of personal integrity and political integrity to say that. I'm not going to support Chris Vance because I'm going to support Senator Patty Murray, who also works in a very bipartisan way.
But you do appreciate what Chris did as a Democrat?
I think it's a – yes. And the reason why is when you're running for office, to be able to be that candid, oh, that – you know, you're – that's a big risk. But it doesn't mean I'm going to – it doesn't mean – I don't have to say that I don't like a person not to vote for them. And I don't have to speak ill of that person that I'm not going to support. So I would say, hey, Chris Vance took a very bold, tough decision.
Sidney Brownstone, the polls seem to be tightening between Clinton, the presumed Democratic nominee, and Trump. Is there some complacency among Democrats that not that he will win Washington, Trump? I think it's probably a too blue a state to do that. But he's unpredictable enough that he could give Clinton a run for her money, even though most polls have showed her ahead up to now.
Yeah, I'm going to hijack your question and take it in a different direction, actually. I don't think Chris Vance gets any gold stars for saying that he's not going to vote for Trump. I mean, Trump is a thin-skinned demagogue who is emboldening racists and acts of violence across the country. And if you don't come out and condemn that, I think you're complicit in the problem. I mean, what's that Edmund Burke quote? Like, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. I don't think Bill Bryant has a defensible position in staying silent. I think you either condemn Trump or you join him. There's nothing in the middle. You can't stay silent and stay complicit.
And finally on this, Rob McKenna, you ran for governor 4 years, of course, 4 years ago. You lost. Would you rather have run that year than this year? How badly will Trump hurt down ballot races?
We don't know yet. I mean, initially I thought he would be very bad for down ballot races. Now I'm not so sure because... He is closing the gap with Clinton. He's ahead of her in the Real Clear Politics average, or was briefly ahead of her. I don't know what the numbers are today. And he is expanding the coalition, if you will, of people who are supporting him. He's supporting a $15 minimum wage. He's against international trade pacts. He's making a play for disaffected voters who are with a populist message. My answer to your question is I don't know yet. In 2012, we had faced a lot of headwind from two once-in-a-generation ballot measures that were on the ballot at the same time around marriage and pot. And they drove turnout very, very strongly, particularly in Seattle. On the Democratic side. So I won a majority of 47 of 49 legislative districts added together. I lost two. So all of Inslee's margin of victory came from two legislative districts.
So you're saying not necessarily would be harder this year?
Not necessarily. Those measures won't be on the ballot. No measure on the ballot this year will have the kind of turnout impact they did. And we don't know what Trump's effect will be yet. We know that the last several Republican candidates have not carried this state. The question is it going to lose by 5, 10, 15, 20 or more? If it's mid to high teens, it's very tough for down ballot candidates at the statewide level, not necessarily at the legislative level. But if he loses by a narrower margin, it may not have much impact at all.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. You can join our conversation with a tweet at KUOW. We are back with McKenna, Sims and Brownstone in a moment. Back now at KUOW, it's our regular Friday review of the big headlines. Here to interpret them, Rob McKenna is the former Washington Attorney General. Ron Sims is the former Democratic King County Executive. And Sidney Brownstone, the current staff writer at The Stranger, Bill Radke, out today. But the show must go on. It's the Week in Review, however. After all, even if Bill can't be here, we must do it. I'm C.R. Douglas filling in for the day. Now, a new twist this week to the state's prisoner release scandal that came to light last week, this new issue. As you may recall, a computer glitch led to over 3,000 inmates being let go early, some of whom went on to commit other crimes, including murder. This week, a new report with a bombshell accusation. GOP leaders of the state Senate argue that a personal relationship between the former head of the DOC, Bernie Warner, and the governor's chief of staff may help explain why the problem wasn't corrected even after it came to light in 2012. Republican State Senator Steve O'Bann helped write the report.
Predictable that a relationship between a member of the governor's staff and the DOC secretary could have inhibited lower echelon DOC individuals from bringing up to the governor's attention this pattern of mismanagement by Mr. Warner.
Now, when pressed, GOP leaders said they had no specific evidence that this relationship did in fact prevent whistleblowing, but they stand by their contention that it created a context that was not good. Now, the governor's office quickly shot back after this report was released. Quote, "The Senate Republicans have now adopted an odd fascination with Mr. Warner's personal life, and had they even bothered to ask us about this, we could have told them that we had established a series of checks to ensure no conflict of interest with our office. They spent $125,000 of taxpayer dollars on a clearly partisan effort that is already being used for political purposes." That statement from Jamie Smith, the governor's press secretary. Now, it's the first we've heard that romance was potentially a part of this early release problem. Rob McKenna, is this new information relevant?
I think it's not as relevant as other facts are, such as the fact that under Mr. Warner's administration and Governor Inslee, there were six different chief information officers at the Department of Corrections. That is clearly a big part of the problem here and their failure over years to fix a fundamental problem. But it is an issue to some extent because Mr. Warner was having a personal relationship with the chief of staff for the governor, and yet the governor is supposed to be Warner's Secretary of Corrections boss. So that is troubling, and I think it exhibited poor judgment on Mr. Warner's part and on the former chief of staff's part. But again, I don't think it's the most important issue that this report raises.
And again, no evidence, although an insinuation, I guess, that worries about Warner's management, or as the GOP senator said, mismanagement, would not have gone to the governor's office because of the worry about this relationship.
Secretary Warner says he had no idea that this computer glitch even existed, that people were being let out of prison early. He says he didn't know. No one told him. That's the question here. You can't get in trouble for something you're completely oblivious to, which he apparently was. So I think that is the more important question here.
Well, and this goes to both of you who have run government agencies. Ron Sims, you've been a manager of a big, not just helping manage HUD, but King County, a big operation. How responsible are you for things that happen a level or two or three below you, and how do you make sure that bad things don't happen?
It's impossible to avoid having bad things happen, and my rule is pretty simple. I will assume responsibility for it, because that way you drive your secretaries and your managers, I mean, you call your cabinets, I'm talking about your cabinet members, you drive your mid-level managers to get on top of things and not all of a sudden distance themselves from it, because I will take responsibility when something goes wrong, whether I knew about it or not. And trust me, there's a lot of times you had no idea what's happening in a large organization, but you bite the bullet, because the minute you don't, but you hold people accountable. So it's the—
In public or behind the scenes?
Oh, behind the scenes. I think that people realize when you got called in my office, it was going to be a bad day. But it's, I think that you assume the responsibility for it. You just do. And it's not fun. People said, why didn't you run again? Because I didn't want to do this anymore. Because you have to assume responsibility in a personal one. You have to.
And what happened here is that I think the governor and apparently his chief of staff failed to monitor Secretary Warner's work, failed to call him to account for not being able to hire and keep a chief information officer for a department, mind you, that has had an enormous amount of litigation filed against it, often over the issue of shoddy record keeping. This should have been job one for Secretary Warner to get these systems fixed, and he didn't do it.
What about you as AG?
Yeah.
Big, you know, what, the biggest law office in the state?
Yeah.
A lot of people. how did you create checks and balances? What did you do when you heard problems that were happening at lower levels?
Well, first of all, before you get to that part, the point where you have problems, you're responsible as the head of the agency to put good people in place. So I put some new people in place. I kept some great people who Chris Gregoire had hired, and I moved some people up, et cetera. So first, get the right people in place. And I think it turns out now that Secretary Warner wasn't the right person to be running that very large department. Then secondly, we created a system of checks and balances within the office that really emphasized bottom-up input and feedback from our staff. I went out and talked directly to my line staff, legal secretaries, paralegals, line attorneys, et cetera, and did not just rely on my top staff. Ron did the same thing. He was very well known. Ron, you were very well known to staff throughout the layers of organization at King County. People knew they could go to the King County executive if they felt strongly enough, talk to him directly. I set up the same systems, much better communication in a flatter organization.
And what happened when inevitably something went wrong?
Yeah.
And Ron talks about taking accountability. What did you do those cases?
You know, look, first, I never said it was someone else's fault. If we made a mistake as an office, the buck stopped with me. I took responsibility. I never threw anyone under the bus ever, because as the boss, that's the fastest way in the world to lose the credibility that you have with your staff. Secondly, I had to fire people from time to time. But third, we put in a much more transparent performance evaluation system where we had people who were bad performers finally being accurately evaluated, and the poor performers tended to leave on their own volition before they even got fired.
Sidney Brownstone, is there enough here to take down this governor? It's, of course, an election year. It's being brought up, this prisoner release scandal, by Bill Bryant, his GOP challenger.
I don't think so. I mean, this is very much in line with what I think Republicans have been doing throughout Jay Inslee's tenure, which is just, you know, dragging dirty tricks and doing power plays, like firing Secretary of Transportation, putting a poison pill in the transportation package. You know, Bill Bryant is clearly not a well-known candidate, so they're using every trick that they've got in the book to try and bring down Jay Inslee. The other thing about this is, like, What is the cause? It was a computer glitch. I don't think that's a partisan issue. I think you look at any level of government across the country and you're going to find inefficiencies everywhere. And I don't understand how the Republican agenda of constantly shrinking government and taking away resources is going to update those computer systems or make them more efficient.
Yeah, except that Republicans are usually accused of wanting to expand the correction system, not shrink it. So that wasn't the issue here. The issue here, as you point out, is that not that a computer glitch is partisan, but that there was a continuing failure to fix it for years and years and years, 16 or 17 rescheduled fixes. It's just incomprehensible that they wouldn't recognize this was a high-level problem. So it does speak to management ability and whether the governor was paying attention or not.
We take a quick break. We're back in a few. It's The Week in Review. It's The Week in Review on KUOW. You likely know Rob McKenna. You may have even voted for him. He is the former Republican state attorney general. He is here. You may have also voted for Ron Sims. He's the former Democratic King County executive. And you may have read Sidney Brownstone, a staff writer at The Stranger. That they round out our panel today. Bill is out for some R&R. A group is gathering signatures for a new ballot measure. Initiative 1515 would require public bathrooms in businesses and schools to be segregated by biological gender. It would repeal a state law that allows transgender individuals to use the bathroom consistent with their gender identity. Now, we talked about this last week on the program, but new information is coming out about this campaign. The initiative has received support from local religious organizations, including Cedar Park Church in Bothell, which has contributed $10,000 to I-1515. Sidney, you've been writing, and I think it's fair to say ranting, about this issue in The Stranger. What's your concern about the religious connection here?
Well, I take issue with ranting. But the religious issue is that Cedar Park Church is tax exempt. And so they are bound by IRS rules that say that they have to limit their political lobbying. Now, if they don't lobby for or against a specific candidate, they stay on the right side of the line. And if lobbying for an initiative doesn't make up a substantial portion of their activities, they get by. So basically, we have a system that says that if you are a big enough organization you are wealthy enough and you have diversified your investments enough, you can throw your money behind a lot of really regressive, hateful things. So, you know, when I went to Cedar Park Church in Bothell, I spoke to the pastor, Pastor Jay Smith. He said, you know, we just want a voice in democracy, but it's a tax-exempt organization. And I don't know, I believe in the separation of church and state. I don't think evangelicals should be dictating our social policy.
What's your view on religious organizations getting involved in campaigns like this, Ron Sims?
I worry. I like a separation of church and state, but there are times, for instance, African-American churches were very, very aggressive and very explicit about supporting civil rights moves. But it wasn't, you know, that was considered to be a political issue. We have fought for civil rights laws. And so a part of me says that I came out of a culture of being a Black Baptist, and we did not refrain from having the ministers on those pulpits and the congregations organize themselves for purposes of political action. But what bothers me a little bit about the tone nowadays is it seems to pick an issue like transgender. If a person should be able to, if a person identifies or knows her of a sex, that's the restroom they should go to. Period, in my mind. Matter of fact, when we were in, my wife and I were in Italy, and I kept, there was a number of men in this one line, and we were all going to a restroom, and my wife finally said, "No, that's a woman's room." I said, "But nobody cared because there were stalls. You went in, went to the bathroom, washed." So part of me says that I don't understand the level of hate behind this discussion. Not an issue of law. The issue of there are some people who we don't like biblically, and I am sorry, I'm from a different view and the purposes of religion being more embracing, loving, and caring than I've seen expressed by some of these churches.
Rob McKenna, they are collecting signatures now, so it's not yet on the ballot, though I think most expect it will be. But assume it is, the issue before voters will be a bit complicated. One thing this initiative does, it seems to treat schools a little differently than private businesses. Describe how you understand the effects of this.
Well, I don't fully understand the effects of this. There's always a risk in writing a ballot measure like this that it becomes overly broad, as we saw in North Carolina, for example. So it isn't clear to me yet what distinction they're trying to make between public facilities, a school, for example, and private facilities, where some laws in some states are attempting to allow private businesses to discriminate. So I think we'll have to unpack this and understand the approach they're taking. It appears to be narrower, on the one hand, than they took in North Carolina. And they appear to be addressing not just restroom facilities, but also locker rooms, which are another concern. And it's one thing to be in a bathroom with a lot of stalls. It's another thing to be in a locker room with showers and so forth. So that concern is being raised. But on the question of church and state, just to be clear about this, you know, you don't give up your First Amendment rights because you're a church or religiously affiliated. That was Ron's point just now. So it's not a violation of church and state for churches to be politically active. The issue of their tax-exempt status is not a constitutional issue. It's a statutory issue. So it's absolutely correct that they have to limit the amount they can do politically, but they don't have to limit that to zero. They can conduct, as we were saying earlier, some amount of political activity as a proportion of their overall activity. So, for example, the Catholic Church has gotten behind measures. I've seen petitions being circulated at Catholic parishes for ballot measures, and I've seen left-of-center churches do the same thing with their political activities right here in Seattle. So I just want to make a point that church and state as a constitutional principle, you know, being separated, is distinct from the statutory principle. Where they can cross over is where the argument is that the federal government is subsidizing the church through a tax break, and that's why you have to have limits on the amount that they can a political activity they can engage in.
Sydney, as I understand it, the current state of law in Washington is that you have to provide these alternatives, and this initiative would basically repeal that.
Yeah.
It would say you don't have to provide the alternatives. You, in effect, could if you were a private business or even a government building. And yet schools seems to have this exception where not only, I mean, they wouldn't be allowed to provide alternative. They must keep segregated bathrooms. Is that your understanding of the effect of this?
Yeah, that's actually a particularly cruel piece of the ballot language. So schools would have to be gender segregated. And let's keep in mind that this specifically discriminates against transgender youth. You know, people who are, you know, in some of the most vulnerable times of their lives, being told that they don't belong in their place of education. So there's that. And then the ballot would allow schools to be sued if they allow trans students to use the bathrooms that that they feel most comfortable in. So not only would schools in have to have gender segregated bathrooms, they would be open to having money taken away from them, to being litigated against if they make their environments friendly for transgender people.
And to the lawyer in the House or to Ron Sims, what do we know about the federal government's effects? We heard a report before a program about how you may jeopardize federal money if you actually have a restricted law like this. That's part of what North Carolina and others are grappling with. Do we lose out on some funds?
The Justice Department has brought the action and said that what we have on the ballot in this state and what other states have done is a violation of the civil rights laws of this country. And the federal government can, and agencies can, upon advice of the Justice Department, withhold funds, modify funds, do any number of things with a state or a local jurisdiction that persists in wanting to violate the civil rights of other people. So this is not something that you can say, we're going to take our stance and we're going to ignore. This federal government will likely take some actions we call high inside pitches to remind people that we are a nation of laws and the civil rights laws are designed to protect people.
It's the Week in Review here on KUOW, back with one final topic in a moment. Back now with our final round. Rob McKenna, Sidney Brownstone, Ron Sims joins us. I'm C.R. Douglas, filling in for Bill Radke, who has the day off. A renewed debate this week about how to move people around the region better. Seattle is about to change its approach about how to measure how well a street works, which could dramatically alter how easy or hard it is for you to get around town and the region. In the mayor's new Seattle 2035 plan, roads and corridors will be graded on not how well they move cars, but how well they move people. Including cars, but also people in buses, in light rail, in streetcars, and of course, on bikes. Seattle Times columnist Briar Dudley does not like this new approach.
Congestion is going to get worse in some places, and not just because of growth. Congestion is going to get worse because we are going to remove lanes that everybody can use, and we're going to divert them to bike lanes and things like that. So, you know, that's a policy decision to make traffic worse.
Ron Sims, is the Seattle mayor doing the right thing by this new evaluation approach to roads, which may involve redesigning some of them?
People are going to – you're going to have roads for bikes and for cars. And you're not going to be able, in my opinion, to limit the number of cars. I mean, when I came here, I said how the amount of tension now just trying to get to this studio – on the roads, you know, I never saw a car jump. I've just never seen anything like this. And I was smiling, saying, I think people are no longer enjoying the experience of driving their cars on roads. And then you're going to give them less. I just think that we're not ready for that yet. But I do believe it's important for people to acknowledge the multiple modes and make sure that whether you that a car and a bike can both ride. Eventually, it's going to be difficult. You're going to want more bike lanes because people will prefer that. But you can't all of a sudden impose it at the moment. You're just going to have to provide that capacity.
Rob McKenna, your thoughts on not just Seattle, but places in the region that are kind of taking road real estate and offering it up to other alternatives. Shrinking the road capacity, if you will, for other means. Is that a viable approach, or is your position that if we're going to add alternative corridors or alternative routes, it should be plus what we already have for roads.
Well, we don't have a lot of room to build new roads or expand roads or highways, and there'll be some improvements at the margin, particularly where we're trying to implement the Growth Management Act and keep the growth inside the urban boundaries. One of the principles of that idea is that you have to make those dense urban areas livable. So we have to be careful not to make them unlivable and drive people outside of the urban growth areas by making it impossible to get around. So taking away capacity that cars currently have access to should be done very, very sparingly. I agree with Ron that adding bike lanes makes sense, and that's a place where I would favor doing it. But just shutting lanes down to try to force people, or taking lanes away to try to force people out of their cars, isn't just bad transportation planning. It will create a popular revolt in parts of our region. We've already seen an uprising over on the east side against the high occupancy toll lanes. High occupancy toll lanes actually make a lot of sense as a way to
on
405. Thank you. They make sense as a way to allocate scarce space, to allocate scarcity. But at the same time, people became so frustrated by it that now they're rising up and they want to overthrow the whole system of hot lanes and HOV lanes. And that shows you how careful you have to be about public opinion and sentiment.
Sydney Brownstone.
Yeah, can we also just talk about this idea about the relationship between single occupancy vehicles and congestion? Because the car, the single occupancy vehicle, is the most inefficient way to travel. We have so many other options. And the idea that in an era where we're dealing with climate change and pollution that you would advocate for the rights of cars, that's insane. We're going to have to radically reimagine the way our cities work. Public transportation and bicycles are far more efficient. And if there's a war on cars, frankly, please sign me up.
We should not be disincentivizing
people from driving cars.
Sydney, it may depend on what you mean by efficiency, but they're not more efficient in terms of actually getting from point A to point B. It takes me a lot longer when I ride my bike down to downtown Seattle from Bellevue than when I drive. My time is worth something. The time of everyone who's on the road or on a bus or on a bike is worth something. So they're not more efficient in that sense. They can be more efficient in other ways. I certainly agree that buses are a more efficient way of moving a number of people through a given corridor because fewer vehicles, more people per vehicle. But let's be clear that people have to get around, and our entire system our labor system and our workforce system assumes people can get from point A to point B relatively quickly.
Just about 20 seconds, Ron Sims. If we get a million more people in the region over the next 20, 30 years, I mean, it's growing huge. How do you do it unless you radically change what you're using the current roads, how you're using the current roads?
With great difficulty. You're going to have more public transportation.
Yes.
It's going to have to be efficient. It's going to have to be fast. It cannot take 30 years to have it built. So you're going to have a lot of public transportation put in place.
Bus rapid transit, which Ron has promoted, is a good way to do
it. And Sound Transit, the ballot initiative this fall.
And that wraps up today's show. You gave us an hour. We gave you a week. KUOW's Week in Review. We thank Sydney Brownstone, Ron Sims, and Rob McKenna. We're back again next Friday when the one and only Bill Radke returns. Thanks for listening.